The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 23rd of October, 2019. On the podcast today, I have John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. And John talks about gold and the following companies: Bushveld Minerals, Keras Resources, Phoenix Copper, and Soul Gold. Plus, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, discusses Bitcoin, Facebook proposed cryptocurrency Libra, and general news in the world of crypto trading, cryptocurrencies. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, in fact, top 10 versions of these lists, and lots of content at voxmarkets.co.uk. And if you do receive an RNS, fire our app, and you like it, the content, give it a thumbs up, and it could appear on this podcast and also on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Now, I don't know how the resource sector is looking, but this week it's been dreadful, really slow on the news front for most small cap stocks. It's literally, even, you know, today, I think about it, on my watch list, I had about four RNSs come out, which is like pathetic. Normally, say, you know, five times that. But it just seems like everything's in a, you know, holding pattern, you know, because of Brexit and all this stuff and everything going on. Nothing's really moving. The market, I find, is very boring. But what's it like your end?
Well, the mining sector, I think, is coming out of hiding. They've had their tin hats on for a while while Donald Trump shells the Chinese in his trade war. But there seems to be a bit of an armistice on at the moment, and the mining companies are putting out news, and some of it's really quite good news.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about. I'm looking at a chart of gold here. It's forming a bit of a wedge. It's rallied obviously recently from that range it was in. This 1300 top of the range really, and then it rallied up to 1500. It's come back a little bit, but it's holding nicely. And do you know what? I'm buying some more gold. I just like gold. I think longer term. Let's be honest. Global growth is slowing down. Interest rates are low. The, you know, central banks are going to print money and so devalue their currencies. Gold will hold, you know, store of value. It'll just go higher, I think. A safe play, you know. And anything, you know, you can see as a positive force on gold in the short to mid-term, John?
Well, we've got the Diwali Festival of Light in India. It's a huge festival in terms of gold buying. They buy 40 tons of gold every year. On the first day of the festival, so it's a big thing. It's an end of summer harvest festival, and they all go out and celebrate, which they should do, and they buy loads of gold as part of that, and as a result, gold, India is a huge holder of gold, particularly within Indian families who store a lot of wealth in there, and that helps the gold price go higher. At the same time, we've also got some saber rattling in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu, who I think has been struggling to form a government out there, and may have just given up on that, has been talking about needing to prepare for war, that the Iranians are likely to have a go at Israel, and they need to be better protected for that. And there's some big headlines, and that sort of thing does raise the perception of global risk. And the last thing any of us want to see is a war in of any sort in the Middle East, let alone one between Iran and Israel. So I think that does raise people's perception of risk, and gold prices could go higher on that.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'm just reading a little report here saying that, I think Standard Chartered it is, saying that they expect the price of gold to go to around $1,700 an ounce this year and higher in 2020, just because, you know, India and China are buying gold. China's gold buying spree tops 100 tons during the trade war. So they're buying a lot of gold. And you've got India as well. Well, you know, you've got this stock-to-flow model, haven't you, with gold. There's not a lot coming on supply. You've got people buying it up. It's supply and demand, isn't it?
Yes, we've got this situation where many of the world's developing nation central banks, and I'm including Russia and China in that, although China is arguably a developed nation these days, they are huge buyers of gold at the moment, or have been in the first half of the year, and they're worried about global currencies collapsing. You know, they need to hold assets that they can monetize. You had the Americans weaponizing the U.S. dollar when they threatened to pull trading in the U.S. dollar out of Switzerland, so they're going to deny the Swiss the ability to settle in dollars. That made the Swiss sit up and pay attention pretty fast and stop money laundering on the scale that they had been. So so the weaponization of the dollar has caused, I think, central banks to decide to hold more gold. And we know that the Russians and the Chinese have an agenda to try and break the dominance of the US dollar as the world's sort of largest trading currency. Which is of huge value to the Americans, of course, and it enables them to borrow billions and billions, and if not trillions of dollars, out of global markets. So yes, there's some interesting things going on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's look at some news, some specific news from companies. What's happening here, John?
Yeah, again, we've got quite a number of clients in the mining sector, and the first of those, Bushveld Minerals. Announced today, yes, Bushveld. It's actually done a great job on renegotiating the terms of its Vanchem acquisition, and I don't think anyone in the market was aware of this. They've managed to knock, I think it was $14.5 million off the purchase price, and they deferred another $23.5 million of the cost through the issuance of convertibles. Now, by my calculations, Bushveld had enough cash to pay the original negotiated purchase price, but they quite rightly went back to the owners of Vanchem and said, look, boys, the vanadium price has pulled back. We need to spend some more money on actually revamping these assets when we get hold of them. There aren't any other buyers around, and I think that's the key point. There weren't any other immediate buyers around. We'd like to pay a bit less for it, and by the way, we're going to give you a convertible note, and it'll give you a bit of upside, but actually it'll help us to defer the cost, so we've got some more money to pay for the development of the Mokopane mine and things like that. And I would call this a textbook management deal. It's really smart, absolutely the right thing management should be doing. I'd love to see more companies do this sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, you've always got to try and get a bargain, haven't you? Let's be honest. No point just accepting the first price. You've always got to try and get a good money for your bang for your buck, haven't you, really?
Well, this is what you pay management to do as an investor. You should pay them to do the best possible deal on behalf of the value of your shares. And if only we saw this in other cases. We were writing about Sirius Minerals this morning, and you know, we watched the capital cost of that project go up and up. But management don't seem to have been able to add value. All they've done is while they draw their fat salaries out of the company, and they are pretty fat, if you look at the annual report. But there seems to be this massive erosion of value, and that's simply not good enough.
Yeah. Cool. Any other news there, John?
We saw Keras Resources get their mining license in Togo, so they can start to build their new manganese mine there. And remember, Keras is distributing the equivalent of its entire market cap in shares in Calidus Resources to investors. I forget exactly which date you've got to hold the shares on in order to qualify for that share distribution. But I wouldn't want to miss that if I was planning to buy those shares.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. KRS ticker there. Cool. And you mentioned, I think we were, before we came on, you mentioned something about Phoenix.
Phoenix Copper, yes, another client of ours. They've been looking at the mineralization at the old Empire mine, which they acquired. It was a mine run by Cambior in the States many years ago.
Yeah, this is Phoenix Copper. It's changed its name. PXG is now the ticker, isn't it? And it's changed its name from PGM, wasn't it? The ticker was Phoenix Global Mining, but now it's more copper-based, isn't it?
Yes. So what they've done is they've identified the same mineralization runs from the Empire mine, which was a good mine in its day, and I think could be a good mine again for Phoenix Copper. But this mineralization extends over a much larger land area through something called Red Star and onto another project called White Knob. So I think...
Sorry, John. That is the schoolboy in me there. I just couldn't help that. So I'm glad it extends down that far. It's good. Right.
I thought I'd leave you a minute there. but White Knob does have some sensible grades. It's an interesting deposit. And the main thing is there's just lots and lots of mineralization that gives them loads more opportunity to work up some plausible mining areas. And I think the first thing they're going to start off with is a little silver mine, actually, which will be good because it'll get the cash flow going and make Phoenix Copper look like a sensible and long-term proposition.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Well, there we are. Put that on your watch list. Sol Gold, you mentioned, do you?
Sol Gold, yes. They've discovered another copper porphyry in Ecuador. So this is good news because, I mean, they did take on this large land holding within Ecuador with a view to finding some hopefully better copper porphyry projects going forwards. Mm-hmm. They're still looking to develop the Cascabel project, but that has has a big capex. And as we see with serious minerals, these things are difficult to do for single project companies. The advantage that SolGold has is, one, it has this very exciting license package within the rest of Ecuador, but it's also backed by Newcrest. And Newcrest, they're the sort of company that can come in and develop a project like Cascabel, you know, a $1 billion project like Cascabel. And there's also BHP in the wings who've in the past made noises about getting involved. I'm not sure they will, but at least Newcrest is there. So you know you've got some sensible backers with deep pockets who could take the project forwards if they chose to do so.
Yeah, and obviously these projects, they are long term. I mean, do you get a sense that any of these companies or in this smaller space are, you know, worried in the short term for this next year, because it's much been marked down as next year is a struggling year. You know, you've got the yield curve and all that stuff, and people are rooming. So the chance of recession is, I think, about 35%, which is quite high, really. Is there any sign that they're sort of tightening their belts or anything? Some of these companies are struggling.
I think all companies should be permanently tightening their belts and being very careful with their costs and their cash flow. But I see things getting better. I think as soon as Brexit is solved and or done in some way, one way or another, and as soon as Donald Trump sorts out the trade war with China, I think the markets are going to take off again, certainly for mining anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if you constantly tighten your belt, you won't be able to breathe after a while, and you've just collapsed, and that's not good, is it, really? So you can have a comfortable level of beltage there, I think, you know?
Well, if the world wants the commodities going forwards, then the world is going to have to fund the development of quite a number of new mines in pretty much every area, particularly when it comes to the battery raw materials. Yeah. I still think that there's going to be significant need for more lithium, a bit of extra cobalt, certainly nickel hydroxide, manganese, and of course let's not forget copper. But these are all really critical metals from an electric vehicle manufacturing standpoint.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? When you think of it, around about I think less than 3% at the moment of the world's vehicles are electrified. Now, to convert that, you know, anywhere near even half of those, it's a gargantuan task, isn't it? And it's to even to supply those vehicles with the right, you know, commodities and parts. It'd be a huge operation, isn't it?
Well, we saw one of the Korean motor manufacturers yesterday delay the launch of a new model or electric vehicle. And they said that's due to a lack of batteries. Now, one of the problems they have in South Korea is I don't think they've been making their batteries terribly well, and they had quite a lot of grid power plant fires where the battery packs, they were using these lithium battery packs where the thousands of lithium batteries are stacked together. And last time I looked, they'd had 23 separate fires within these grid units. That says to me they've not been manufacturing terribly well, and they need to get the quality control sorted. The Japanese are rather better at their quality control, and I'm less worried about batteries from Japan. And I think even China isn't too bad at the battery production, so they're quite well focused on it. And of course we've got companies like Northvolt and Volkswagen looking to do the same things in Europe, but they're certainly a few years behind. Northvolt employs 300 people, but they don't seem to have got terribly far with it yet. But certainly there's more to come, but I think it's going to just take a little bit longer than some people expect.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Lovely. John, thanks, that fella, and we'll speak to you next weekie.
Look forward to it. Thank you, and hopefully we can show you some pictures of the White Knob prospect.
Oh, very much. I don't know. I say I very much look forward to that. I don't know if I do actually. There we are. But there we are. Thanks, John. Thanks for that. Bring that picture in my mind. I don't think I need. Yeah, do you know what? I think I do need to see the pictures to get the picture out of my mind. I've got in my head at the moment. But thanks, John. Speak next week.
All right, bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, author, trader, author of The Crypto Trader. It says here, in a little ball, top left corner here, real life winning trades and strategies. Yes, real life. Not just That's fake right. stuff. Not your fake stuff.
That'd be funny. You know, the publishers were very, very insistent that I include that real life bit.
Otherwise, if you put fake there, it wouldn't have worked out so well. Fake winning trades and strategies.
I think the point that they were making, to be fair to them, I think, when I got them to explain why they were so insistent on real life, is that a lot of trading trainers, you know, the kind of people who online advertise their services to teach you how to trade, a lot of them don't trade themselves. And, you know, so they're kind of talking theoretically.
What a scam.
Well, it's kind of more like maybe they used to trade, but they got sick of it, and so they turned to teaching.
Yeah, you get regular trading income, I suppose, less risk. I mean, yeah, but
it's not the same, you see. If you're, you know, that's why they wanted me to include the real life. If you're actually right there at the coalface, then I think you have an extra insight.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy who comes on, when I look on YouTube, because obviously the algorithm, they send you ads about any kind of financial stuff that I'm looking at, and their ads are normally, I get ads from traders, you know? And yeah. I got this guy come on, hi, I'm Jeff Big Balls, and I'm the most successful trader in the world ever. And, yeah. You know, he's on a plane, and I say, well, hang on, why are you selling a course then, if you're that well off and you're in a jet? Why are you just selling a course? You know, that's
they
ridiculous.
They always claim to have made sort of several thousand % profit a year.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
I've
earned
money.
I've earned more money than there is on the planet. Yes, and this other guy, I think he's English. I mean, he's a bit smarmy. Hi, I earn millions of pounds in my 30s. Would you like to do that too? And then, whatever you do that, what are you really just teaching trading courses? I mean, if you earn millions, but only 30. Then why not do something, you know, I don't know, sort of worthy, go and help some people in poor parts of the world, you know, do something rather than just sell trading courses, you know. I think rubbish. But the trouble is, people, have, you know, they'll put themselves on a private jet, they'll hire for half an hour, or they'll sit in a nice room that looks expensive, and people believe them, you know. I think, well, I don't understand, you're selling a course, and you can earn millions. I don't understand the point of that, really. There we are. Anyway,
I'm kind of torn on that issue of the course, because I haven't made a trading course myself, but I can see. I'm considering it.
No, I can
because so many people have asked me to do it. People who've read the book go, right, you know, they get in touch with me, they email me, and they say, oh, you know, that was great, the book, but and I learned so much, but I want to something more in depth. Do you do any kind of a course?
I always have to say no. Yes, listen, I'm not against...
Basically, I haven't bothered to do it, but...
Yeah, but Glenn, I'm not against courses, right? I'm not against that. What I'm against, essentially, and maybe I'm, communicate this well. What I'm against these guys who claim they're super, super mega wealthy, rich beyond wildest dreams, but then they're selling a course. Don't give that side of it. Just, you know, be honest. Say, listen, I'm in a decent living doing trading, but I also want to supplement that income with the trading, with the course. What's wrong with that?
Yes, and, you're absolutely right. Because that's the sensible way to do it anyway, you know, like me, because I didn't start off with wealthy parents. I've been building up my wealth slowly, and I was able to leave my job at a certain point and just do trading, so, you know, which I've been doing for the past several years. But yeah, it's got to be a slow progression, because you don't want to risk crazy amounts of your money. You know, risk and reward are kind of related to each other, so I have to be pretty conservative with my trading in order to not risk my children's future, frankly. The people you're talking about, they claim to make thousands of percent profits a year, which is A, not true, and B, what generally is the case is that when they were very young, like there's a famous guy with his bar mitzvah money, for example. He had a bar mitzvah when he was 13, got money from relatives and so on, and just basically made a fortune very quickly on trading, you know, and I assume taking insane amounts of risk in order to make large amounts of money. But that was kind of a one-off event. And after he'd done that, then he's kind of been slow and steady for about 20 years since, plus selling courses and all the rest of it. But he still holds that up as the kind of the dream. But it's not realistic to make thousands of percent a year unless you risk it all, unless you risk everything you have.
Yeah, and you don't see anyone like sort of, hi, I'm Bill Gates. In the 1980s, I started a software company. Now, it's done very well, and I'm one of the richest guys in the world. If you'd like to start a software company, I'm going to start a course on how to choose. But, you know, what I'm saying is, these people aren't that wealthy, otherwise they wouldn't be doing the courses. They've probably done well. Yes, and that's probably the thing. What they're doing, exactly what you just said then. In fact, I've had that guy on the podcast, Tim, isn't it? The guy kicked Tim. But they've probably done that. They've probably done that, earned a nice chunk, being a bit risky, and realise, oh, hang on a sec, I need to earn a recurring revenue that's a bit safer, that's it. But don't put yourself up there, you know, as some kind of multi-billionaire who could buy the planet and then selling a course. It doesn't make sense to me, you know, but if you could
Have I just slagged off one of your podcast friends then?
No, he's not a podcast friend. No, I mean,
he's not a friend of the podcast.
No, I've had him on twice, I think, but he is a big flash seller. And he even, one of his YouTube videos, he got a Rolex out and throws it into the crowd. It's like, mate, come on. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? I just find, what a waste. You know, you could have just sold that and give it to charity. And why are you just throwing it in the crowd? That's over the top. Saying, I've got so much money, I'm selling a course. Doesn't make sense, you know. But there we go. Anyway, let's talk about crypto, Bitcoin. I tell you who is very well off, who's done very well, doesn't need to sell anything, but I just genuinely think he's an alien who wants to rule the planet, is Mark Zuckerberg.
Berg. Well, indeed. And actually, it's interesting, another thing you never find is...
Mark Zuckerberg.
Is people like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates, after they've made their fortunes, you know, with their businesses, what they never then do is start earning thousands of percent a year as a trader, day trading the indices or the forex markets, whatever. They never do that, do they? Yeah. I think people need to kind of bear that in mind as well, is that the richest, cleverest people in the world generally don't do that kind of crazy trading, which is advertised to us by people online. Anyway, but yeah, Mark Zuckerberg is speaking to Congress on Wednesday.
So boring, that would be. He's the most boring guy in the world. He's a robot, isn't he? That's why.
He's probably not behind closed doors. You know, he just obviously has to put on a show whenever he's in public.
But he's
a great guy.
He's an IT geek because he's boring. He's the biggest IT geek in the world. He's the most successful IT geek, apart from Bill Gates, of course.
But I think you've got to bear in mind here, a lot of your listeners, or some of them at least, are probably IT geeks, and they're probably very fascinating people, not the way you've characterised.
They're not. They're boring. but to be fair, Bill Gates I find very interesting. Mark Zuckerberg, I don't. There's something odd about him. I do not think he's part animatronic or something. There's something wrong there. He doesn't have any emotion. But what's he saying?
Well, he's saying that his statement to Congress has been released ahead of the actual speech, as is the way these days. And he says he's kind of backtracking. He's backpedaling on Libra, the virtual currency, cryptocurrency, if you want to call it that, that he has been kind of setting up in league with a lot of other companies. You remember there were 28 big companies. Some of the biggest ones, like Visa and MasterCard, have now pulled out, which we talked about last week.
I know why they pulled out. Because they met him in person, shook his hand, felt the coldness of his skin, and that guy is something wrong with him. That's not a man. No. And they just felt a really cold chill going on their body. Let's leave. Let's get out.
I'm sure he's a great guy. He's a stand-up guy.
Well, because these robots these days are very convincing, aren't they? Have you seen those Boston Dynamics? They're scary, those robots.
Those are amazing. Yeah. Astonishing. I love those videos. Anyway, so this is what he was is saying to Congress. He says, "I believe this is something that needs to get built, Libra, the cryptocurrency, but I understand that we're not the ideal messenger right now," he says with characteristic understatement. He also goes on to explain that he wants to make it happen, but not until the US regulators are satisfied. And that is a pretty big hurdle to overcome, because the US regulators have got some very serious concerns about Libra. And previously, Mark Zuckerberg had kind of implied that they might go ahead, you know, because it's a worldwide project, they might go ahead even if the US regulators weren't entirely satisfied with all their assurances. But now he's pretty much saying, no, we're going to delay it until US regulatory concerns are addressed. And, you know, who knows how long that could be? It's like Brexit, isn't it? How long's a piece of string? It could just go on forever.
Yeah, well, I just think you're not going to get it passed, because the US regulatory people want, or the powers that be there, want the US dollar as the reserve currency of the world, not some alien's, you know, cryptocurrency. So,
he has a warning as well. He warns, he says, while we debate these issues, he's stressing to Congress, the rest of the world isn't waiting. He says, China, he brings up the spectre of China.
Oh, there we
China,
are. That's the threat.
He's saying, his work.
They know, listen, they're in a trade war, China. Essentially, the trade war is down to America trying to stop the advancement of China becoming the biggest economy in the world. You know, they're trying to hold them off or delay them by another 5-10 years if they can with the trade war. And so he brings up China, their biggest rival.
Yeah.
I said, they're advancing.
China is moving quickly to launch similar ideas in the coming months, he says. Libra will be backed mostly by dollars. And so I believe it will extend America's financial leadership as well as our democratic values and oversight around the world. If America doesn't innovate, our financial leadership is not guaranteed.
That's a good card to play that. Oh, he played a clever one there, didn't he? Really did. He just stood back. He said, listen, if I do stand back, you know what's going to happen? The Chinese are going to be reign supreme. I'll just stand back, yeah? You can take your time. But while you're taking your time, the Chinese are going crazy, and they're taking over the world.
So, exactly. And because Donald Trump has slagged off Libra in the past, he said, you know, that he sees it as a massive opponent to the dollar. And he's like, the dollar will always be the number one currency. This Libra is no competition. So now, obviously, Zuckerberg is changing the framing of the whole thing and making out, if you want the dollar to be strong, then you want Libra on your side, because it will be backed mostly by dollars, as well as a basket of other currencies, which he doesn't bother to mention, but it will be backed largely by dollars. And he's right, though. China is making steps to make its own digital currency, a sort of state-owned digital currency, and they already have the infrastructure in place with things like Alipay, where people are already using their phones to pay for loads of stuff in China. They're way ahead of most of the world on that, so it's a relatively small step for them to introduce an actual proper digital currency to run parallel to the yuan. And I think he's right. I think Zuckerberg's right.
But do you know what? He's wrong in, well, Trump is wrong in one respect, but also he's wrong in one respect. I tell you what will be the reserve currency of the world. Bitcoin.
I mean, yes.
What do you think about it, right? The dollar, it's been devalued. What, 90% of its value has been devalued since it was invented? So it's inflationary. the Bitcoin now at the next halving that happens, it goes below the banks, the Fed and the Bank of England's inflation target, which is there's 2%. It'll go down to 1.8% inflation in Bitcoin itself. That'll decrease again in 4 years' time. In fact, every time there's Bitcoin in circulation, inflation goes down. So at the moment it's very volatile, but I think the more adoption it gets and institutions are coming in, I think the bigger it gets, the less volatile it become, and that will be the stable currency. And I think, if you want to exchange, let's be honest, we are going digital. If you want to exchange money in a stable, towards a stable currency that has no inflation, because that's what you have to, you can't rely on an unstable currency. And that's the problem Bitcoin's got at the moment. It's quite volatile, but also because it's helped the dollar as well. But I mean, if it's more stable than the US dollar, what are people going to exchange to, in the end? If it's very easy to do it via digitally, they'll exchange between currencies, between Bitcoin. It's happening in all these countries that are blowing up, like Venezuela, Zimbabwe and all that. People are using Bitcoin, and it's not Bitcoin at the moment. It's still very volatile. If it stabilizes, and in fact, what we've seen in the last, it's been the most stable, since that drop recently, it's been the most stable I've seen for a long time. It's like just trading on a ruler. It's like a really flat line of support, isn't it?
It is. So, straight. Though it did have a bit of a drop yesterday after that news that Mark Zuckerberg dropped there, saying that Libra is, being delayed sort of indefinitely, and that caused I'm always a bit skeptical about whether a piece of news is really the cause of certain price rises or falls, but I think in this case it correlated pretty well. So it made people get a bit down on Bitcoin. Plus, Bitcoin trading volumes are historically pretty low at the moment. Everything's gone a little bit quiet. If you look at the chart, it's kind of looking a little bit bearish as well, as we were talking about last week. But you were making the point just before we started the podcast that it all depends on how you look at it. Whereas I'm saying, the price is looking like it might fall further, is a little bit in the doldrums at the moment. You said, but if you're an accumulator of Bitcoin, then now can be seen as a good time,
and
not a bad time.
Yeah, and lots of people are.
A final chance to get it cheap, if you will.
Yeah, look,
I suppose. That's one way of looking at it.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I've signed up for quite a few, because I've bought a bit of Bitcoin recently, and I've been buying a bit more. I've been signing up for all these email newsletters and alerts from Bitcoin, and institutional take-up is getting bigger, And like I said,
it is.
What's going to happen is, when you have something like the supply going down, and a finite supply, and demand from big money going up, it's only a matter of time before, especially with this massive, huge milestone coming up, which is the halving next year. It's the last two halvings, it's rallied within 6 months before and a year afterwards. And I've actually gone back, looked at the price, and put it into a spreadsheet, and I'm going to do a little video on it, looking at the probability of it rallying again. And so the 14th of next month, November, it'll be 6 months, right? Mm. 6 months. Let me just get the figures up here. This is a phenomenal amount of rise. So here we go. So after the first halving, right, if you invested 6 months before the first halving, a year after, so that's 18 months pretty much, if you'd held for, you'd have done 19,000%. And even the second halving, obviously it's gone bigger, but if you'd bought in 6 months before and held for 18 months, you'd done 500%. So,
isn't the halving kind of already priced in, surely? It's a piece of news that everybody knows about.
Well, no, going on this is not, is it? Because it's 6 months before it starts to rise. So that's when it's going to happen. If you hold for a year afterwards as well, because obviously supply goes down then, it's going to rally. And I think now we've never had a halving where institutions have got access via futures, and there's all futures exchanges now, there's BACs, there's ICE, there's all different kinds of ways. There's funds setting up, and the record amount of inflows from funds investing in crypto. So there's never been a halving when we've had this level of institutional inflow. So I think the demand has increased. And like I said, at the moment, you know what it's like. When the shares trading lower or going nowhere, there's always lack of volume. Yeah, and you only get chasers, like traders or chasers. When the price starts to move, that's when the volume starts to go up. But there's people slowly accumulating all the time. That's for the just average or low volume. But when it really starts to move, it has this exponential effect of people will buy. There's lack of supply because people know the halving's coming anyway, and that will be going down. Then the price will move higher. more people will buy, lack of supply, and it'll just go bonkers, you know? So I just think at the moment we are, you know, almost six months away. Well, on the 14th of November, we'll be 6 months away from halving. And traditionally, that's, you know, if you've held for like 18 months, you've done very well.
Well, you make a good point as well about the institutional investment and also just general widening of access. For example, just this week, NASDAQ has listed its first cryptocurrency index called the KIX 100, made up of, you know, 100 leading cryptocurrencies in a kind of in an index. And, you know, it's kind of developments like that, and we get something like that every few weeks.
Yeah, it's incremental,
isn't it? It just kind of broadens access, and it allows people who normally just buy stocks and shares to kind of get in on the crypto action in a more traditional way through NASDAQ or through, you know, some other traditional stock exchange. There are products listed on stock exchanges now, futures exchanges, so people don't need to necessarily venture to the kind of dodgy crypto exchanges based in tax havens that I've tended to kind of, you know, go and do some of my trading on in recent years. And of course, you've also got in Europe and in Britain, we've got things like IG Index and all those spread betting and CFD companies that also offer cryptocurrency related products. Though, of course, there is the specter, as we've talked about in the past, the specter of the Financial Conduct Authority clamping down on that kind of thing, which I think is a really backwards move. If they start banning CFDs and spread betting on cryptocurrencies, it will just drive people to the unregulated exchanges.
Yeah. I mean, it's happening. I mean, I said, I just listened to lots of podcasts of guys who were very, and I just thought, before I really knew anything about Bitcoin, you know, I just thought it was a lot of hype, a lot of hot air, people hoping to be rich. And but I'm listening to some very intelligent guys. Some of them are run funds, like is it Morgan Creek Capital just announced they've just raised $60 million. This is the second fund they've done. And also Grayscale, they've had their biggest amount of inflows into their, and they are a crypto fund basically, amount of inflows from institutions, 84% of the money is from institutions. The biggest inflows,
it's coming from a very low level though, to be fair. Grayscale are the biggest of funds, but they're still, their percentage rises in investment are coming from a very low level, if you see what
well,
I mean.
Well, hang on, listen to this. They've had a quarter of a billion inflows in Q3. Inflows have tripled quarter over quarter from 84 million to 254 million in Q3. So why is that gone up so much in the Q3? So, and it's just it's slowly incremental, you know, like you say, from the NASDAQ to all these bits of news coming together, and you realise in the end it'll be a tipping point. And I think you put together that plus this halving coming up, and all you need is a big milestone that'll raise people's awareness. And all of a sudden, it'll go bananas. So that's why, you know.
It could well do, which is why I've dedicated my life to it.
Honestly, Glenn, it will go bananas. You've got to, rather than be a trader, just start accumulating slowly, little bits of Bitcoin here and there. And, you know.
Little bits and bobs.
Not trading it. Like, it's different between renting a house and buying a house, you know. You've got to buy the house to make long-term gain. But that's why I'm slowly accumulating. I just genuinely think in the next 6 months, this price will start to rise, and then you'll start to see interest going. And I see it all the time. It's amazing how many people follow companies on Vox Markets. We've got a list called the top 10 most followed companies.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how many companies on there are being followed just because their price has risen. You know, and these are small cap companies. That it'll be a spike. It'll come back down quickly. And yet people are starting to follow it now. Hang on, you've missed a spike. Why don't you just do the research beforehand? And maybe, or, you know, people buy the spike all the time. And that's what encourages more, you know, people to buy the spike.
So, but once again, though, why am I
buying? Because he's buying. And that's it. So that's in it. And that's what happened with Bitcoin last time. And because it's such a lack of supply, it will go bananas, you know?
Well, you say it will. It probably will, or there's a high likelihood it will. But nothing's for certain, which is why I see myself as a trader rather than an investor. We've talked in the past about, well, you know, my entire book sort of goes on about the trades, the real life trades that I've done in the past, and how I made, you know, really good profits on Bitcoin was, for example, by buying it during that 2016-2017 boom, but then selling it near the top of the boom because I knew that how volatile it is. And indeed, there was an 80% decline. I would have lost 80% of my money. Of the money that I put into it, not all the money in my life. But, you know, I would have lost 80% if I'd held. So this is one of the reasons why I have a real problem with investing, sort of buy and pray that kind of strategy. Why not ride the waves, the big waves? I don't ride the little waves. I try and ride the big waves
where possible.
The ones that last for ages, and then I sell at the top and miss out on the 80% decline and then buy again when things are kind of starting to perk up.
I tell you why, because it's like buying digital gold. And yes, I did see Mark Yusko on CNBC talk about Amazon's volatility, you know, and no one's actually held from start to finish, because obviously you're not going to tell. But I think Bitcoin's volatility will slow down. I think it'll rise quickly, because the bigger it gets, like anything, you know, like any company, you know, small cap stocks are very volatile. You know, the bigger cap stocks are not that volatile. I mean, if you look on Vox Markets, we've got a markets page and it's got the risers and it's segmented into FTSE 100, FTSE 250. And I'll look right now and I'll give an example. So if you look at the FTSE 100 and you look at the winners there, so the biggest winner is at 1.5%. The biggest loser down 3.2%. Now you've got to aim, right? And you've got the biggest winners at 56%, the biggest loser down 20%. So you see, so as you get bigger, it'll be less volatile. So I think that's the way it'll go. So we've seen, I think the volatility will come out of Bitcoin the bigger it gets.
Well, you say that, but Bitcoin on its own is worth hundreds of billions of dollars now. It's like,
you know, if it was a billion,
Yeah, so if it was a company, it would be amongst the largest companies in the world, and yet it still rises by thousands of percentage points and then falls 80% or even further. So it's still insanely volatile for something of that size. But I agree with you, over time, and if you look at, you know, for those who are mathematically inclined, if you look at a logarithmic chart of Bitcoin and how it kind of moves over the years, you'll see that it is remarkably actually getting less volatile slowly over time. Yeah. It's just that it started from such an insane level of volatility that now it's just down to kind of semi-insane volatility. Slowly but surely. And actually, a very important point to make is that about institutions that you said before, that institutions are slowly getting in. We've got to remember that most of the world's biggest fund managers, pension fund managers, you know, all the sensible custodians of people's money, they have very little, if any, exposure to Bitcoin and to cryptocurrencies as an entire asset class at the moment, because they still see it as a little bit young and a little bit scary. But as you get all these products listed on respected indexes like NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange and so on, once you get those kind of crypto funds, which is starting to happen on there, then the temptation is going to be for them to start moving at least a percentage of the world's pension fund assets into cryptocurrencies. And they're going to, once we get the next upturn, for example, they're going to feel such intense pressure from their clients to have exposure to cryptocurrencies as well. It's as you say, it's all going to kind of grow. It's pretty much inevitable because cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin have been around for a decade now, and they are not going anywhere. They haven't died. And that's kind of the important thing. And that's why, as time passes slowly, pension fund managers will get used to the idea of, we need to have exposure to all asset classes, including cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's the best performing asset, you know, for the last 10 years since it's been around. But I see Bitcoin different from other cryptos. I really do. Just because, and I put this in my five reasons why I bought, it's sheer dominance and liquidity means institutions can get access to it, and that will drive its dominance again, and it'll reduce supply and increase the demand, you know. So it's that kind of, you know, self-fueling sort of, you know, and I just say it will become a reserve currency, and I think it'll be challenging gold for a market cap which is like several trillion, you know. But I just think it'll go that way as everything goes digital. Why carry around, like, so at the moment I've got gold as well. I've got the ETF and gold, and I think gold's going higher because what we've got is economy slowing down. We've got interest rates near zero. You've got, in fact, several countries now bonds, you know, minus zero. So all they can do to stimulate, if we really slow down, is print money. When you print money, do you value it? And, you know, so you go to gold or you go to somewhere else that has less inflation. And that's Bitcoin. We're going digital, you know. So I think it's, in the end, I think it'll be massive, crazy.
And when you've made your Bitcoin fortune, are you going to be one of those guys who shows off on Instagram in your private jet?
Yeah, I'll be like that guy chucking my Rolex at the window, and then half an hour later just come and fetch it, even if it's a fake Rolex. You know, yeah, chuck that Rolex out there. No, I mean I'm using it as a hedge with gold. You know, I just think, but I think it'll outperform gold. But I just think when you know, central banks start printing. It's happening now. It's like ECB said, it looks like it's going to be QE forever, which means we're devaluing the currency forever. And it's happening now with the Fed as well. In fact, the chairman there, what's his name? I can't think of his name. But he said they're doing QE, but it's not QE, but they are doing QE. They call it something else. So he's injecting cash into the markets.
Well, that's the irony, is that even though people say, well, Bitcoin isn't a real thing, it doesn't even exist, but in a sense, it's actually the ultimate hard currency, even though it doesn't have any physical presence. It's a hard currency compared to all these endlessly printable national currencies.
Jerome Powell, isn't it? In fact, did you see that bank? It's a German bank. I can't think of what it was. It's the seventh biggest German bank. So it's
Deutsche not, Bank, I think.
No, it's a small.
They did a
review of the first time ever they did a study on Bitcoin.
All right.
And they said that one of the summaries was it's designed to be a harder asset than gold. And there's a stock to flow ratio. So at the moment, it's 25 Bitcoin, silver's 22, gold is 62. In 2022, stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin will be higher than gold. So, I mean, scarcity, coming on, it's coming into supply compared to gold. So they say, and it's easy holdable. Gold is easy to store, is easy to transport. Bitcoin is a lot easier to transport, and it'll get easier, as mainstream adoption happens. So,
it's like a question for a Christmas cracker. What's impossible to touch but harder than gold?
Oh, yes, I like that.
Bitcoin, There you go. I'm going to sell that to a Christmas cracker company.
I'll sell it to some of the answers might come out sexual, on a Christmas table. So, you may be careful of that. If you've got kids at the table. Marvellous, Ken. Thanks for coming on. Anything else?
That pretty much.
Are you plugging anymore? Can people see you anywhere? Can they touch your skin anywhere?
Got any plugging to do? Yeah. Well, yes, Friday. You've only got a couple of days left to get in there for the London Investor Show, which is in Hammersmith this Friday. Loads of great speakers. Who's there? Rodney Hobson and John Stepek, the editor of Money Week, and Tim Price, who I love.
Who's Tim Price?
Do you know Tim Price?
No.
Tim Price, he's a kind of fund manager type guy, but with really interesting and strident views. You should get him on the podcast sometime. He's great. He's a great guy. Very interesting guy. Anyway, but lots of good speakers. But me speaking about cryptocurrencies. I'm on a panel and I'm doing a speech all sort of after midday. And yes, and you can get in free with my special code. Remember, as I like to say, Goodman19. It's Goodman19. You just go to the London Investor Show's website and on the registration page, put in that code and you'll get in for free instead.
Do you know what I think you should do? If someone comes up to you and asks you that question, saying, Glenn, what was that question you said for the Christmas cracker? If someone says that, you should give them a copy of your book for free.
I forgot it already. What is impossible to touch but harder than gold?
Yeah, if someone comes up and says that, you should give them a copy. It's not going to happen. We couldn't even remember the phrase after a couple of seconds. Marvellous. Anyway, just say that to Glenn, and he may give you a kiss and a cuddle. Lovely. Glenn, we'll speak to you next week.
Good stuff. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Alpha Growth. That's ALGW. At four, Itaconics, ITX. At three, Gene Drive. That's GDR up 10%. At two, Vast Resources up 15.25% at 0.34 pence. And number one most followed is i3 Energy. It was up yesterday, big rise yesterday, but it's up to 17.6 pence, down 2% today, actually. Top five most liked RNSs are as follows. Metro Bank, board update. Basically, chairman there, Vernon, is stepping down. At four, U Group, Ofgem supplier licensing review. At three, Ncondesi Energy, solar battery project and working capital facility. At two, SolGold, regional exploration update. And number one, most liked RNS, came from Kefi Minerals. First, here we are. I don't know how to pronounce that, obviously. Drill hole hits massive sulfides. Not a ramp there, then. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.